I have you. I'm Rachel Jankovic.
Becca Merkel.
And Becca Merkel, grandmother twice over now.
Guys.
Our little hiatus was a grandmotherly one.
It was, because he was a surprise plot twist, was born 5 weeks early, which is crazy.
Early is what it is. It took everyone by surprise.
And we all had to suddenly scramble and feel unequipped for where we were in life.
And the cute clothes that were taken to the hospital were the size of three of him.
I know.
Super, he's doing really well.
He's just adorable.
He's so sweet, and he is a little five pounder and didn't need really much, which is awesome for that early.
He's
doing great.
But they did have to stay in the hospital like 6 days, but it was not a NICU baby. It was
Really, God was very kind.
So kind.
But that's what we've been doing. We've been doing very nice and godly and good things.
Having major life transitions is what we've been
that's
doing.
That's what we do.
And
then today.
Yeah, you're on a road trip with us, you guys. I don't think we've ever done road trips with the listeners, but here we are.
Yeah, well,
a short road trip.
It's because I purchased a white couch. We can't know what level of bad idea this is until later. We'll find out is what's going to happen. But I stopped in a thrift store in Lewiston, which is it's a beautiful drive from Moscow.
30 miles.
Yeah, and anyways,
so it's a baby road trip.
Little miniature. It's the road trip that you have to take if you're going to Costco.
It's a road trip we take all the time.
If we need to, yeah. But anyways, I had to come back today to pick up the couch, which I think it's the original upholstery on this couch, but it is pure white. Like, there's been nothing has happened to it, and it's an old couch. But I suspect it may have lived long under clear plastic. Mm. I can't be sure, but I think that might be...
Well,
it
seems like the only explanation.
Well, I mean, yeah, because it had, like, dust in some places on the arms.
Yeah.
Anyways, we'll see how long that lasts at my house. But I'm planning to put, like, a quilt over it or, like, you know, like, I feel like we'll make it happen.
Yeah,
so that's what we're doing.
Anyway, so you're going to come along with us. We're going to pause as we have to... sofa into the back, and then we will take you with us back home again.
It's amazing, but it's this beautiful, beautiful weather here.
Oh my word, you guys, it's like a glimpse of spring. I'm sure we're gonna relapse into blizzards soon, but
I don't think a blizzard.
It'll be a big pretend.
Those memes about winter storming back in and yelling and one other thing and then slamming the door. However, this week is like, it's like sunny and 70 today.
But see, do you remember, someone just shared today, like, happy 15 days to slow the spread anniversary.
Oh my word.
Which means 4 years ago, that's what we were doing today, was having those announcements. And if you recall, during those early days of quarantine, I remember it being, like, gorgeous. Like,
yeah,
this.
It was.
And then I remember distinctly a blizzard. Mm. That we had that earthquake that was out of nowhere.
Oh, yeah.
Then, yeah, it really felt like the apocalypse.
We're having a big time then.
But anyway, I'm just saying, I recall this weather blizzard back to
Becca, just the other day. In fact, when I was at Costco last, I was... just wowed by a situation where I was kind of near this couple, an older couple, who were not wearing masks, which is surprising given what occurred. And then another woman who was probably like 20 feet away from us coughed.
Uh-huh.
And she coughed, it didn't even sound like she was really sick. You know, sometimes someone coughs and you're like, oh, you know, you're really... got some. This was kind of more like she coughed, but it sounded like she coughed for a reason, you know, like to clear something.
Yeah.
But it was not actually, it's not a traumatic cough.
Yeah.
I put it low on the scales of that. And this older woman, her husband turns to her and he's like, so should we go? And she slapped both hands over, like the cough happened. She slapped both hands over her mouth and nose. She's like, we have to go now. And and like they were gonna stop and drop their whole Costco order because someone 20 feet away from us coughed. And I thought to myself, there are people still living in weirdly in terror of something that is nowhere near as dangerous as what they are getting into for safety measures. You know, like getting, it's okay, crazy.
This actually reminds me of something that I was thinking about. Social media threw me a video the other day that did take me aback. I was like, whoa, and I watched it. And it was, when I was done, I was like, well, that was a glimpse from another planet right there. But then I was like, but something about this makes me wonder if these are Idaho people. And I look, yeah, it's Idaho people. And so it's like, okay, so it's not really another planet, but I thought that there was a familiarity here. But it's a couple, and they look quite nice. I mean, they look like a sweet couple that probably are Christian. I don't know. Like, they didn't quite look Mormon, but they might be Mormon.
Okay.
I didn't go researching this further, but it's a big prepper thing. It's like, you know, we're getting ready because 2024 is going to be a terrible rocky time.
Oh, right, yeah.
So they're, like, prepping to batten down the hatches for I don't know what they anticipate coming. I didn't double-check to find out, like, are you worried about the election or is this just... But it's the kind of thing where it's like they look very, very accomplished at the prepper lifestyle. Like,
sure.
Like, if we had something go wrong with the modern world, these are people you'd want to be friends with because they clearly are knowing what they're about when it comes to this. And they're like growing all their own food and they've got all of the safety nets in place for if we run out of water and if we're, you know, and we're going to have all this silver for bartering with and we're going to have.
Oh.
Yeah, it was like crazy. It was so many things that were like, all right, so if everything did go down in a blaze of glory, you guys would be prepared for at least the first year, you know, you're there for it. But I suddenly started thinking, like, you know what's interesting about this is that, sorry, everyone, we're going over a bridge in the Snake River. What's interesting is that this is the kind of thing that I think many Christians would see as just a positive virtue of, you know, like, preparedness and, you know, prudence and wisdom. And, like, these are people who have it together. And I suddenly was like, you know, but think of that parable of I've got my grain in my barns. I am ready. And, you know, God says, this night your life is required of you. And I was talking to Ben about this. And I was like, it's weird because, like, on the one hand, you can see the appeal of it for, you know, why Christians would gravitate towards that. And he said, yeah, but you know what it is it's prepping in the wrong place. Not that you should never be prepared, but it's like you're putting all your eggs in the basket of preparing, laying up your treasure here instead of, you know, and it really is an interesting thing.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, there are people for whom laying up their treasure here
Even if their treasure is just whole grains and the readiness to feed yourself.
Yeah, like
part of this is just an overcompensation to our cultural loss of understanding, because there used to be a time where everyone would have known how to do a lot of these things. So it wasn't as much of a you didn't have to be any elite housewife to know how to handle the chickens or what to do. And now there are different directions that people have to, you know, get very, kind of go very extra in different areas to learn and try to get it to be. Because there's a lot of things that I have tried through the years where you do it and it just feels like it takes you forever and it is hard and it is, and I mean hard even in just a tedious kind of a way.
Sure.
But a big part of that is because it's like not a, I don't know what the like one step outside of like it's just in no way routine for you. So you have to keep going back and reading. Sort of like, I know I could make cheese, but it's not in, an intuitive process to me, and I would be glued to the step by step by step of it. And at the end, you might be like, the output here was not worth the amount of mental effort that cost me. And some things are like that. I haven't gotten to the cheese making, and I'm confident it would be that way. But that is how it is, like, with canning, like when I can beans or whatever, that the first couple times I made a much bigger mess than I wanted to. It was far more invasive in my life. It was like, took me too long. And then you kind of work it down to be like, oh, this is one of the things you just know how to do.
Yeah.
And I think that is that. There were times where people already had some of that know-how. It didn't take them anywhere near, because you grew up around it, so you already knew how to.
Yeah, it would be far more intuitive.
Yeah, you're like, this is just what we do.
So it's sort of like at some point in your life, you learned how to parallel park a car, and, you know, now you just do that.
When you have to.
I'm not sure.
Whoa.
I understand.
Sheesh.
But it is funny, though, because I do think there are people for whom this is obviously a hobby that delights them, is getting prepped for 2 years of, you know, like, I have water stored up for
a
year.
I've got us covered on corn tortillas if the apocalypse arrives.
I have to tell you, Rachel.
Oh, I know it. Heather told me, and I saw the same thing about tomatillo husks.
I tried it yesterday.
And it worked like a
Heather
charmer.
Did I tell Heather?
No, Heather Wilson told me Becca has a trick. And I was like, I saw the same video because I follow Macienda, and Macienda commented on that video.
Yeah.
Saying you make our tortilla press look good or something.
So the thing you do, you guys, this I did a sample yesterday. And Rachel is doing all the high-tech, exceptional corn tortilla work. I myself am not that invested in corn tortillas, so I have to use dried masa. It's me with the dried masa. But if you, like me, are a low achiever on corn tortillas, this is an amazing trick. So Rachel's like steeping corn kernels in lye and putting special machine.
Lime calcium.
So I, though, have my bag of masa that you mix with water and salt, you know, and you do that. Well, this was basically take your normal corn tortilla recipe, but
which is almost always one part masa to one part water
and
however
salt.
Much salt you.
Right. But you take boiling water, peel, for me it was like eight tomatillos, throw the skins all in a bowl. And then we used the tomatillos to make a fresh salsa that was delish. But anyway, and then you pour your boiling water over the tomatillo skins, let it steep for like 3 minutes, and then wring them out. And then use the water in your
tortillas. Yeah.
And it's the combo of the hot water and the
enzyme.
I've used warm before, but I've never used hot. And then whatever is in the
skin. It's like some kind of an enzyme in the skin.
It basically created these tortillas where after they're done, you can take it in your hand and scrunch it up and squeeze it like in a little ball and then open it up and it doesn't tear. Like,
it's the best.
It actually was quite good. But hold on, we have to pause.
We're going
to
go pick up my couch. We'll be back. We'll be back.
Hold that thought, guys.
And we're talking about the old salvation story.
Welcome back to What Have You After the Couch is in the back of the Suburban.
It's in the back, and we unfortunately, neither of us remember to put a bookmark in our conversation.
Mentally.
This is exactly what happens when we're supposed to send a summary. You might wonder why sometimes our summaries are so vague. It's because we don't know. It's the reason.
What we haven't done is remembered. we were talking about prepping.
Yeah.
And the sort of laying up all your worldly possessions and thinking, more importantly, that prepping has always been a thing. For Christians to feel like it's just simply wisdom for us to be so consumed with the here
is,
and now.
Like, there really is a virtue in being prudent. But there also is a vice in being overly concerned with, you know, your welfare in a way that...
Yeah.
And that sounds wrong. But you know what I mean? Like, as Christians, there are things we should not fear. I think that's what started me off down this rabbit trail.
We were talking about the fear, yeah.
The fear. And it's like, there are things which you have to be able to trust God, keep your hands open.
Yeah.
And don't have your security, your feelings of security.
It's actually
in how many canned jars you
totally. And it is actually the same thing. Like, if you were facing a really bad diagnosis of some kind, it's wise to try to get to the best care that you can get to. But it is foolish to put your trust in the Mayo Clinic. Like, and the temptation is very real to be like, well, there are professionals out there who could solve this. And we just sometimes have an easier time having faith in our own, like, self-reliance skills.
Yes.
And so we work so hard to build those up rather than to be thinking that the faith we need to have should be in a different
and
place.
And I think it's funny because the whole point of that parable is that this is a guy who felt like, you know what, the contingencies are covered. I covered the possibilities here.
Mm-hmm.
And then when God says, but you know what, I'm going to ask you for something else.
Yeah, it's like impossible.
You could spend, like, so much of your time prepping for the apocalypse when... actually what God is going to send you is a house fire that burned down all of your prepping, or he's going to say, you know, like, what is the catastrophe that you're prepping for? Because there could always be a different one that undercuts all of your preparations here. And which is not to say you should never think about it or you should never be ready for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, I do think there's a temptation to put your trust and your security there when it's like, but you know what, you're not omniscient and you don't
when you start feeling fearful, your instinct is to start building up the what you have here.
You know what, I have to say, yesterday it was Josh Edgren did the call to worship at CCD. It was so good, but he was talking about what is worship, what's, you know, like, what is it actually? And he was talking about how it is that which we owe to God and to no other, where if you were to give it to something else, that's what idolatry is you're giving something over there that should be only given to God. But he connected it to fear, that you should fear God
and no other,
nothing else. And I think that that's when things can go screwy, where it's like you're afraid of a medical catastrophe, so you put all your trust in your... in your research and your
food, and your vitamin and regime and your no BPAs and we're
and that reveals that your fear is a health thing, or maybe you're putting all of your effort into getting ready for an economic collapse because that's where your fear is. Which again is not to say there's anything wrong with taking care of your health or being ready for stuff, but
totally.
But it's when the fear dominates. That is the thing that reveals that you're putting something there that belongs only to God.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're prepping for whatever the contingency is, like, let's say you have invested everything in your health, but then you got hit by a bus, you know, where you don't know what's coming. And I think that's the whole point, is you're not omniscient. So that's why you have to put your trust in the omniscient one.
Right.
Because
totally.
That's where you should be laying up your supplies.
So actually reminds me, there's so many things that are good and healthy for Christians to do or to think about or to pursue. You don't need anything else while we're down here.
I do not.
Okay. That are important, you know, like that are good things to do, but that there is so much ungodliness in the waters around it. So sometimes you might just really easily and naturally, like, accidentally slip into something. We've talked about this before on the podcast, specifically about fitness or health or weight loss or whatever, that the way people talk about how you ought to be motivated or how you want is, like, so bad that it is actually really hard to be in that world at all in a way that is godly. Meaning, no, I mean, it actually just takes constant awareness of what you're doing. Yeah. And one of the things I was laughing, just talking with Luke about this the other day, because as I am, well, but beyond my incredible cleanser sizing routine, which I do have to say, as a funny aside in the update in my fitness and health journeys while I run around my house and try to clean up, it's getting much harder. Which is very funny, is that
Is that because it's spring break and everyone's home?
No, I think it's because I've done enough of it to have made it harder to get my heart rate up. I keep having to run around the house a few times outside.
Which you could see if you could work in gardening.
I think, I did work in, like, running around outside picking things up. I mean,
Dig a hole.
But we have been on spring break, so my routine is a little messed up anyways, but I have a hard time, as one would expect from my life history. My core is more my structural issue.
Yeah.
And anyways, after having a baby, it takes a while for my, you know, you just have things that are not all of the joints loosening stuff happening. You have to be careful. Anyways, I went on a run yesterday, but when I was talking to Luke, which, guys, picture the most glorious, amazing job. That's what I did for a mile.
Oh, yeah.
1 mile of excellence.
Yeah, a 31 mile.
Yeah, no, no, but could have been. Anyways, what I was trying to say in all of this is that it's like I want to be, like, when you think in terms of what is a godly framework for losing weight, getting in shape. And it is not, if you're a person in my position, it is not to recover what you've lost. Because what I've lost, some of what I've lost, I lost forever having spent it very well. Like, spent it and invested it in something wonderful, you don't get it back. And there's no, like, the motivation to try to undo what you gave freely and that was a wonderful investment is, like, I don't want that back. It's like, what I want to do is steward my remaining resources well. You know what I mean? But I'm not trying to pretend you're a different age than you are, pretend you're not, that you're in a body that hasn't had 8 children. Because it turns out that's the one I'm in, guys. It turns out. And the thing is like, what a gift it is to have used it so hard and that God, like, it's great. But at the same time, when you start things like, I want to be running or I'm dieting or whatever, it is so easy to get into a bad frame of mind that is like,
wow, there's so many hideous ideas on how to motivate yourself. And
right,
they come down to the old unholy trinity of guilt, fear, and shame.
Always.
You're guilty because whatever. You're afraid of your health. You're ashamed of your body.
Because then if you think about the shame, it's always that, like, are you bikini ready?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the shame should be, no, think of what a blob you will look.
Yeah.
And, like, well, yeah, and to and be so, clear, we're not trying to get bikini ready. But the point.
That was my whole point.
I meant in case we have listeners.
Yes.
We don't wear bikinis, and I just wanted to put that out there.
Rachel just rolled her window down, so we have a motorcycle and 2 semis here at a stop sign.
But it's beautiful weather. I just felt like I had to, sorry.
You're all having to put up with it.
I'll put it up. What I was trying to say is that, yes, and guilt is the, you're so gross that you gained 10 pounds.
Or, like, some of the, you know, sometimes you see it, like, couched in Christian terms of your body's the temple of the Holy Spirit.
Stewardship issues.
How are you going to be able to actually fulfill your Christian duties if you're not fit? And have I, on the podcast before, did I talk about that one guy that we listened to in Israel? don't know if I did.
I don't either.
But it was just a blessing.
Oh, I think
it
you
was
did.
A blessing. He was a, he's a pastor, but he's a pastor in Palestine. And he was so fantastic to listen to, because that's a guy who is actually risking his life every day. Every day. And he is literally staring down death threats every day. Mm-hmm. And there was a convert, I think, that was, his father was a leader in Hamas or something. And so that the father called with a death threat in the middle of the night. And he said, you know, I'm going to kill you, whatever. And the pastor was like, God put me on this earth and he will take me off of it. And he said, and if he uses you to do it, then...
It's not. It's kind of like, it's no matter to me if you're the one. Like,
so, good night. You know? So basically, this is a man...
Bless him!
...who has faced far more actual threats to his own life...
Yeah.
...than anybody in a nice Reformed church in America ever, ever has.
Yeah.
And it's directly for the gospel. And the fact that he did it bravely and cheerfully and just... real self, kind of self-deprecating and just funny. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know what? That had literally nothing to do with how much time he spends in the gym. It has nothing to do. That is one of the most fearless, strong,
totally.
Brave men ever. And you know what? He looked nothing like
a powerhouse of, strength.
That everyone's like, if you're going to do your masculine duty as a Christian man, then you must be able to deadlift X much weight. He couldn't. There's no way this man would have deadlifted that much weight.
That's an example, too, of, like, stewarding your fitness is a great thing to be doing. And, like, to some extent, every Christian needs to be doing that. But you also need to be doing it in a way that you're accomplishing your real duties, not...
Right, and I think that we can work up these little motivations to ourselves that are sort of like, well, if I was that fit, then I would be a threat to any challenge to my family, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm just saying...
You're like, no, that man has
that
way more of the pure masculine resistance than any of us.
Just brave and strong and fearless in the face
Love
of
it.
Like genuine.
That actually sounds like, oh, I don't remember the name of the missionary, but when he was going to go to the Pacific Islands and the only missionaries who'd been there before were killed and eaten right away.
Yes.
And when he was like, I think trying to raise support. And some woman was like, but don't you know, maybe it was a man actually, like, you could just be eaten by the cannibals because that was what had happened to the last people. And he said, it makes no difference to me. I was like, I'm going to die one way or another. And he was like, so if my body is eaten by cannibals or eaten by worms, it's neither here nor there for me. And it's just sort of like, I mean, I get that you're holding that out as like the ultimate fear. But the funny thing is, it's not that being eaten by cannibals that was so scary. It was death. That was scary, and that's what he clearly highlights. Like, this body is not going in a glamorous way, whatever happens to
it. So I do think that we often try to motivate ourselves with the guilt of how will you perform XYZ Christian duty if you aren't physically fit and running a certain amount.
And this is exactly the same thing as the prepping, which is like, how will you perform XYZ Christian duty if you're so obsessed with yourself?
Right.
Which is much more of a handicap than 20 extra pounds.
So it could be the guilt of that or fear of, you know, health problems or shame. When all of it needs to be motivated by gratitude and contentment and joy.
Well, and the opposite of fear, guilt, and shame. Those, so everything is the opposite. Like, gratitude is really, I would say... I mean, like, which one would you say gratitude is the opposite of?
By the slalom course of semis.
Yeah, we really hit a little
little
rat's nest of semis.
We're going up a crazy grade right now, which has a stunning view, but it does mean the semis slow way down.
But interestingly, we have a semi in the passing lane, not going faster than the one in the right lane.
But he is doing a good job in the left lane. Anyway, the opposite of guilt, what would that be? Just
freedom.
Freedom, the opposite of fear.
Would be, I actually think gratitude, when you were saying that, I was trying to think about it. I was going to say gratitude actually seems like gratitude, because it is a right relationship with God, is like a polar opposite of all of them. Gratitude actually sums it up for all of them.
We can often try to motivate ourselves to change by
guilt, for sure.
Doubling down on discontent.
Uh-huh. Oh, or like the people are like, make a vision board of all the people you wish you looked like. Whoa.
Yeah,
like that
envy.
That won't do a good job. What that's going to do is nothing of value.
And it's like, if you're trying to earn your way out of it somehow by motivating yourself through various vices.
Uh-huh.
Well, A, you're wrong-footed. I mean, you just started wrong-footed. And then B, it's not going to last. It's not going to be under God's blessing. It's like you have to be able to offer this freely and joyfully and contentedly.
In a way, it's not just, it's offering your body, but it's also receiving it, right? And one of the things, like, because that's what gratitude is receiving the situation that God has put you in. And I've said in other places that I think people are just messed up in what they think good body image is, because good body image, people are like, you need to be proud of your body. Like, you need to be able to show your body to the world and not mind, because you know it's causing envy, or you're just so confident in who you are and how wonderful you are. And you know, that's just a sad messer of a place to be, because even the best, beautifulest of us all fade and wither and grow old. And even if you manage through all kinds of dark magic to not get fat ever and to keep poofing up your wrinkles with stuff, you cannot hang on to it. It is only passing you by. And the interesting thing about that is that I just will say good body image is being able to see yourself in the mirror, looking at your body in a mirror, and having a good and happy relationship with your creator. Like being able to say, not, wow, Rachel, look at you, but thank you, Lord, for this. Thank you for this.
Like, let's say you really are in a really sinfully, like, you've gotten into a place quite sinfully.
Yeah.
Right? Like, let's say you're so obese, and you know as well as anyone what got you there.
Yeah, that it was your anxiety binge eating. Sure.
Anxiety binge eating, or just plain old run-of-the-mill gluttony, or whatever it is. Lack of self-control, something else. Then, you know what? You confess those things, and then you try to change those. You know what I mean? Like, okay, now I'm going to work on getting better at self-control, or I'm going to get better at ridding myself of the anxiety or whatever. But you give it to God and then move on from a place of forgiveness. And if you got there through a lot of just happy fellowship at the church potlucks and a life of just, then you know what?
And a slow metabolism.
Then, yes, or a health problem or whatever. Just, you know what? Work on it and try to get rid of it as cheerfully and happily as you can.
Be glad and grateful. And actually, one of the things that does need to be mentioned in this, I think we said this before on the podcast, so I may just be remembering the quote from ourselves. But if you got in sin and you disobediently got into a bad situation, one of the wonderful things about being a Christian is that you can like the fat rolls, and I'm going to put here for any of you who tend towards the anorexic, the ungodly skinniness that is a sign of ingratitude and a wrong relationship with God and a personal power trip.
Probably like, also guilt, fear, and shame.
Yeah, but if you're really skinny because it matters so much to you that you be in control, that is as wicked as over gluttony. Yeah, and the thing that needs to be said about any of these situations is that wherever you are, repent and look to Christ. And the thing is that in exactly the same place, like I think the thing I was thinking of is us saying, as soon as you get things right, your disobedient fat rolls can be obedient. Like your, you know, excessive skinniness can be right with God and doing the work to get out of it. So
let's say you've gotten yourself into appalling debt because of a lot of hideous choices, many of which were sinful.
Sure.
It's like, you know what? You can repent. You can be right with God. And then you can cheerfully, gratefully, contentedly turn and try to work your way out of it. And, you know,
exactly.
It's fine. But, like, you can't sit and, like, envy your way out of it or guilt yourself out of it or whatever. It feels like it's a similar thing where it's like, you could sit there and beat yourself up about what a horrible person you are to try to motivate yourself to get out of debt. Or you could look enviously at other people who have money and try to motivate yourself that way to get out of debt.
Uh-huh.
But it's like, no, if there was sin, confess it. If there wasn't, then thank God for it. And then try to, you know,
yeah, totally.
Your situation.
Okay, this brings up something that I meant to bring up late in the day here, but I was talking with my kids about this because I think social media, we were talking about fitness, and I think the human heart prompts all kinds of terrible things on that front, but it also prompts you, because if you're like trying to get fit or you're trying to diet, it's very likely that you're reading, like you're going around reading materials or looking at different worldviews that are offering you different things. And so, you know, like, whatever it is, you just need to be thoughtful.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I think is a weird danger of social media that is, I don't think there's anything new under the sun in the sense that it's the same old human problems,
but
it's like happening at a kind of speed that is really hard to ascertain. It's hard to figure out how we're going to, how to counter a lot of this. But one of the examples I was talking with my kids about is, and I don't know this woman, I'm sure many of you have seen her. She's actually a funny comedian. Like, she does funny videos. And I do have seen a number of hers that make me laugh. Her delivery of stories is funny.
Right.
I think her name is Elise someone. She's funny. The one that I saw that made me really get the giggles was when she was a waitress. She worked as a server for like a catering company. And her boss told her that it was really important to this bride and groom that all of the serveware be edible. And she was just like, that's super weird. But they're like, yeah, so everything that we have here is edible. This was like a big thing for the bride and groom. She thought that that was really odd, but they were like these little edible plates, little tiny whatever, serving platforms. And she, at some point in the event, the bride sees her and was like, have you had one of these? And she was like, no, I haven't. And the bride is like, you've got to have one. And she was like, okay. So she's like, but I knew it was like really important to them that this plate is edible. Everything's edible. So she stuffs the whole thing in her mouth. And then the bride is like, did you just eat the plate? And it turned out that it was biodegradable. And she just like choked down a little serving. And I don't even know. I can't imagine in what world you could find something. I don't know if her boss told her the wrong thing, what happened, but whatever happened, she ate the serving thing also. And that was how she found out it was supposed to be biodegradable, not edible. She's very funny. And everything that I've seen of her is she's a very sympathetic character. She tells a story in a funny way. She's sweet. I think she's a mother. She, you know what I mean? Like, she's whatever you could like, but so as much as it's not foul content, it's not nothing, but one of the things that she's really into talking about is her anxiety and her depression.
Okay.
And she's like trying to be a platform to kind of spread awareness. She's trying to be encouraging. She's not trying to be so like a lot of her humor depends on the like how anxious she is about a situation. Right. So she's being weird, you know, like and basically you have someone that is, but like that is a bizarre kind of a backdoor to really Christless teaching that you may never like. And I think of this specifically with teenagers, because they could be watching things, listening to things, trusting people, like coming to really like people as characters, trusting them and being taught in a very incidental, almost community kind of way, things that are totally counter Christian. And the reason I brought that up, okay, look it up in my, I think I have to show my, look in my Instagram messages, and you can read this question, pretty sure it's an Instagram question that we got, okay, in my direct messages that we got today.
Okay.
It's a picture. So if you go to that, then I respond that one. No, second one.
Sorry.
One down. That one. Read that, because I said I would bring it up on the podcast.
Okay. Let's see if I can. Hi there, Rachel. Wondering if you and Becca would have any insights regarding what seems to be surfacing more. I'm sorry, I have to zoom in and then I have to keep scrolling back and forth.
Okay. So well, I can summarize it my best, but...
Kids who go to therapy, or even more common, I go to this church, this church and therapist and biblical counselor. I did benefit from a stint of therapy years ago and was able to untangle some specific things. But more recently, I have felt that the only reason I needed to go to therapy was because there were gaps in my Christianity. Maybe asking it like this, Maybe asking it like this will get to what I'm curious about. There seems to be this ethos from the pulpit in Christian circles that I've run in, typical non-denominational community churches, where we are okay with being stuck. I don't know how else to describe it. There is enough self-awareness that we are sinners and that God has grace for us, but almost like there is not a mentality of success with things. And I've heard many times, many times of therapy or counseling being mentioned as the thing that finally helped click or strengthen their walk with the Lord. But they had to go outside the church to get it. Like, church provided the knowledge about God, but therapy had the tools to help me figure out how to process what was going on. Did God design the church or even the family unit to be sufficient, or does therapy, counseling provide tools that we can't get in the church? There seems to be such a language gap between a pastoral approach and therapeutic approach, but could the former benefit from the latter, like other kinds of specialists we would use as a resource? I'm just unsure what categories to put things in, and maybe my modernity is showing in even asking these questions. So as a listener for a couple of years now, I've heard you guys walk through a level of self-awareness and dealing with sin and wrestling for joy that I haven't experienced as common, and I'm hoping to glean some principles for thinking rightly about this issue. I really appreciate you and Becca taking the time to have a podcast. So
basically the question is, this is why that reminded me, the Elise thing reminded me of therapy being like becoming a real normal, a normal thing that we talk about. Like there's a Pandora ad that keeps coming on in my house that is recommending, it's like all relationships take work. So it was telling you to go to, I think it's an internet therapist, but it wants you to take all of your friendships to therapy. Like you and your friends, your siblings, your parents, everyone needs to be in therapy.
I think, you know, I mean, I don't know where you were going to go with this question, but I think, like, obviously, I think I wouldn't call it therapy. There's a very important place for getting biblical counsel from someone when you are in a
particular pickle.
Yeah. And so, absolutely. And I do think that probably it's kind of like, you know, like, let's say you have some community that had some wildly horrible toxic waste spill, and everyone in that whole place is suffering from some kind of chronic illness, right? I feel like our culture is suffering from the chronic illness that came to us from a weirdly individualistic, detached, Christless
mm-hmm.
modernity. You know, like, that is, it has treated everyone to all manner of issues. And so there are people who, you know, they're kind of like in the ICU from the get-go, you know?
Sure.
But at the same time, ideally, you wouldn't do that. Like, it would be like, ideally, you
well, I think
have
that's
everyone
like,
in a community.
When you talk about therapy, you could be talking about it like it could be a cast or an ankle brace. And you could be like, are there situations where you genuinely needed it?
Yeah.
And it was like, yes, absolutely. Are there situations where people need to be put in a body cast? Yes. Are there situations, and when it comes to things like therapy or counseling, now, I would distinguish pretty heavily between therapy and counseling, because absolutely. Biblical counseling is actually the work of just another believer
right.
coming alongside you
yeah.
who doesn't happen to have all their emotions entangled in the same
yeah.
thing, and can consequently, hopefully, Lord willing, provide more clarity
yeah.
on things. Because when, especially if something, if it's a marriage, big marriage problem, or
yeah.
it's something that is really harder to see objectively when you're in it, then a biblical counselor is actually someone who's holding the authority of Scripture present in your situation
yeah.
with you at a time that you maybe really need help with that. Like
yeah.
that there's no, that you're just not going to be able to do it by yourself. So I would say that's like going to the hospital. Like, you need counseling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes I think the threshold for when you need counseling, it's fine if it's actually pretty low, because a good biblical counselor should tell you when it's pretty low. Like, should tell you, you don't actually need counsel on
and
this. Like,
be,
you just need to do the
yeah.
thing that you don't want to do.
And it just, that it might be a friend. It might
right.
be.
But that level, I would not say you have to have obtained a huge injury. I'm saying if something big has happened, like, say you found out your husband had an affair, I would say biblical counsel is not optional. Like, I would say that's a time when your
yeah.
your pastor, your elders, people need to be involved.
Yeah.
And you need biblical counsel, because that's what the church is for. And that's what it's
yeah.
for. But I would say in that case, as much as possible, it should be someone who's connected with you in real life. Like, I know there are times when that's not the case, but it really should be your pastor, your elders, not just someone on the internet where I can fire off a random accusation about my husband and then they'll counsel me back.
Well, that's
so
the thing is that the distance provided by these online counseling things, in one sense, I understand, like, okay, there's the benefit of the sort of relative anonymity. But at the same time, it does mean that they are, by definition, not hearing both sides of the story, which means that
not seeing the whole picture, not able.
And they don't have an eye on.
I think that actually just appeals.
It's better than nothing.
But yes, but I think it can also appeal to people who don't want to hear the biblical counsel of the people who are in their life. And so, all that said, I think biblical counsel may actually be the level of you calling a friend to say, hey, what am I doing wrong? I'm having a terrible attitude about this. Like, I'm totally joyless. I don't see it. What's, you know, whatever it is. It could be very low level problem that you're just, that I would say is biblical counsel. When you're calling someone who believes God's word and is not afraid of telling you you're in sin.
Well, and let me throw in there. If, like, let's say you call your friend to say, I just need counsel because my husband's being such a jerk to me, because he won't let me buy the thing and he is such a tightwad or whatever. Well, then that your biblical counselor right there, friend, should be the kind of person who says, you know what, I think you need to make it right with your husband that you called and told me that. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Sure.
Like, it's, it has
it needs to
have
be someone who'd be willing.
Right. Somebody who's willing to say, you know what, you're out of line for sharing this. Or maybe just say, does your husband know that you're asking me? Make sure, you know, like,
yeah.
Or whatever it may be.
Yeah. And I would say, just to round this out, if you're having a problem that is like a, may require medical intervention, right? That you could be having depression problems, like, who knows? There's a big area where there is a lot of overlap because we are both spiritual and physical beings. There is a big area that would require a lot of wisdom. And what I have told people when they ask randomly is that I'm not opposed in all circumstances to medical interventions with things, with, you know, if it was depression or whatever. But I do think that it is really important that you find a medical provider who believes in sin and who would be dealing with you as more than just a physical
right.
being. And that otherwise you can just get on the pharmaceutical conveyor belt of a very godless system that thinks that we can solve everything without God.
Yeah.
It's all a chemical issue. It's all whatever. So I just putting that out there. Now the final element is the therapist that may be a completely secular therapist. And I don't think there's any, and actually I would actually say, except for in very rare, I can't actually think of a time that I would say you should get therapy from just a general therapist. But I would say that a lot of awful damage has been done even by so-called Christian therapists.
I can just say firsthand, I have witnessed people...
Multiple
people who basically went the distance of burning their entire life down with the therapist standing at their elbow saying, okay, pour the gasoline now. Okay.
Yeah. There's actually been times where, like, there was a situation, I have experienced that with a situation where it was more like, it's like the therapist becomes a worm tongue.
And absolutely.
You know that we did not get into this situation that we find ourselves in suddenly without, there is another person in this.
Yeah.
And that has happened. I've seen it happen in marriages where it's like suddenly the wife is just like basically she has removed herself to a different universe kind of in her head. And a lot of miles have been covered because they're being covered hand in hand with an anonymous therapist from the internet.
Yeah.
And it.
Many, and the ones I've seen were Christian ones. Like,
yeah, I'm labeled Christian.
Square
coat
Christian. Square. That's hard to
square
say.
Square quotes.
Not square coats, but.
I think. The square coat Christians are among us. That's actually pretty good because I can think of it being like a lab coat.
Yeah, exactly.
But the square coat Christian therapists. Anyways, the problem there is that all you're looking for is like a little stamp or a label. Honestly, you have no idea who that person is or what they actually confess to or how they, like, you could find a pro-choice Christian therapist.
Oh, yeah.
Easy opeasy. So like,
and how many marriages have they burned down?
I know. It's almost like a little side hobby with some of these people to put however many, you know, like the old fighter pilots putting the little
notches
on their plane. It's like you feel like the Christian therapists are like, how many more marriages can I destroy? Because I have some great ideas for how to do that.
Yeah.
And they're not. What they're not doing, they're going in and it. They're using the tools of a therapeutic age that is totally godless.
Yeah.
And so it is not like they, it is not a, it's not a, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not a discipline. It's not a place that you go. Like the whole toolbox is not godly.
No, I would say big hard pass to the idea of ongoing therapy, but biblical counsel, absolutely.
Yeah, and I actually want to put a little, we said ankle braces or casts or whatever, and you know the thing of, like, if you sprain an ankle, starting to wear a brace on it is actually, like, the worst thing that you can do for yourself, because what you do is you take a little injury and then you make it stay weak.
Oh,
and instead of recovering the strength, like, there was an injury, but you need to recover the strength. And this is what happens. Like, a lot of the time in a marriage, there could be some kind of a disruption that does actually cause an injury to you, but it needs to actually be dealt with in a way that does not become your lifelong
limp.
Like we want to deal with it in a way that is resilient. And and I would actually recommend, I haven't read the book, but I'm planning on it, the Abigail Schreier book, Bad Therapy.
Yeah.
Because I think the entire premise of that is that we're making everyone crazy weak.
Yeah.
And this is what I loved about that question, is her saying that as she's grown in Christ, it's made her feel like it was gaps in her Christianity that needed. And that, I would say, I think is totally the case for many people. They're like, I don't have the tools to do this, but it's really because you don't know what tools you have in your, in your faith.
And I do think that if you have a functioning church and a functioning community and functioning families, that drastically reduces, I would think, the overall desperate need that everyone has.
Yeah.
Because that's what I mean about the toxic spill where everyone in the town is sick. I feel like we have not very functional churches, not very functional families, not very functional communities. And yeah, everybody's desperate sick, but that's not a great place.
And they're totally ripe for those square-coated therapists.
Oh my goodness.
Well, anyways, all right, guys.
I need to say, though,
did you have a tip? Go,
that Read the Room is officially finally out.
Look at it.
On Canon Plus. So just all of those people who have asked me over the last few
now
months,
go feast your eyes upon it.
The answer is there. It's officially dropped. So
great.
Yeah. Do you have, I gave my tip. Tomatillo skins. If you, like me, are the underachiever on the corn.
Okay. Table. I have a tip.
Do it.
Well, it has to do with tacos, corn tacos. So you can do both of these things. Has to do with tacos. Not specifically a corn taco, but a...
But you can try it.
But I mean, heck, if you want to, you do it. I made carnitas.
Okay.
In apparently a traditional manner.
Okay.
Where you...
Dug a pit in the backyard.
No.
Because of your cleanser sizing, you ran out and worked on that pit.
Yeah. No, and actually this carnitas was maybe the opposite of a fitness journey, really, because but it was pork shoulder, and I ended up with 30 pounds of pork shoulder, so it is a lot.
It's a lot.
But you cook it in lard. It is like braised in straight lard.
Is that why you were posting that lard?
Yeah.
Oh, I have to tell you something.
And you cook it, but listen, it was bizarrely, outrageously delicious.
Was it?
So that it was all these chunks of, so I cut it into, it was like 30 pounds of pork shoulder, but I cut it into a lot of bigger, not huge, but chunks. And then it was like the peels of a ton of oranges in it and bay leaves and all this stuff.
Is this like a Cuban-y sort of
No.
One?
No. It's like,
traditional. Okay.
Yep. And you put, apparently also pouring a Coke in it, but I didn't have a Coke, or pouring some beer in it, and I didn't have a appropriate Mexican beer, so I didn't. But you put all the pork in it, and you braise it in the fat. But the amazing thing is so tender, and then when you pull it all out, you just sear it. You can just throw it in a pan, and it crisps the outside of it really quickly, or you could do it in the broiler. Whatever, and it smashes up. But the reason I was excited about this is that my previous methodology for doing the pork, the carnitas, would not feed a crowd because I do it in a pan, and then the crowd of my family, it's hard to get enough of it. And so this was like, you can do a huge batch and then strain the fat, the lard, and put it in the freezer, and you can use it multiple times for this. But then you can also freeze the I froze a bunch of the roast all ready to just be pan seared, like thawed and then pan seared and caramelized.
That's smart.
Since I have so many tortillas, I'm going to have to get through. It's important that I find ways.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's my tip.
That's awesome.
Carnitas and lard. That's
well,
it.
I was going to tell you, speaking of lard, I know everybody's into doing things with lard and tallow and whatnot, but it's generally like rendered lard, you know, or mm-hmm. tallow. I saw this crazy thing, which always delights me. I don't want to try this. Nothing about it makes me want to eat it, but I love finding out that there's a whole wing of the world that you knew nothing about previously.
Right.
It's near Carrara, Italy, where the marble is.
Okay.
It's like a mile or two away. So wherever that may be in Italy, there's a guy who takes slabs of lard. So just straight off the pig hunks.
Okay.
It's a special breed of pig that's not overly flavored because he wants it to be like a real, like, blank canvas. And he has these massive marble tanks that are square and deep. Like, I don't know, you're picturing sort of like a big ice chest and then double height.
Okay.
With a marble slab on top. And he gets in there and starts layering up these massive hunks of lard, covering it in salt and spices, and then another layer of lard, and then more salt and spices all the way up. And some of the versions, he's got brandy in there, steeps this thing for like 6 months in there, and then pulls it out and is selling it to Michelin-starred restaurants and stuff. Like, it's this incredibly high-end lard. And then it was saying, really weirdly at the end, like, make sure you eat it, like, cold, because that's the sign of cheap, like, lard that isn't very good, is when you have hot bread and lard, like, that was invented to cover an inferior lard. So, you want to, like, and I'm going, like, what? Like, what? What is bread and lard in the first place?
Wow.
And how did I know. But
so,
I just,
is it raw lard?
I don't know.
Is it cured?
Is it cured? No.
All the salt?
Sure. Tons of salt, and then, but just layers all the way up, and then just in this marble tank for 6 months.
Just at ambient temperatures?
I don't know any more than this. It was like a very, but it just makes you feel like, okay, there's this whole large.
There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, that are dreamt of in your philosophies. There we go.
There we go.
On that elite lard memo. All right.
All right, we got that out.
Until next time.
All right.
Bye-bye.